Ladies and gentlemen, once again, this broadcast has been recorded way in advance for your listening pleasure and my living pleasure. Today, you know, public radio exists thanks to the support of a large number of totally disinterested corporations and of listeners like you. Well, we spend much of the rest of the year paying tribute to those corporations. Today, a tribute to public radio itself, and by extension and implication, a tribute to listeners like you. Hello, welcome to the show.
CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is All in All. All in All, at Once Weekly, Once Over Deeply, on a not-so-top news story of the day. I'm Ira Zipkin. Every day, cigarette smoking becomes a more difficult habit to maintain. Cities and states pass more and more restrictions on where the habit can be indulged in, and many smokers, unable to quit, are feeling the pressure. That's where the community of Oak Falls, California, entered the picture, with a new law that's all smoke and no mirrors. Aviva Schlarman sent this report back from Oak Falls.
Like a lot of communities here in California, this town was rather whimsically named. There's no falls here and virtually no oaks.
Mayor Art Carneros knew his town had a problem.
It's flat here, no real tourist attraction, and the recession hit us pretty hard. But right over there, that's where the borax plant used to be. Now there's few customers who are still in the market, they get their borax from the Japanese at half the price. Beats me how they do it. So anyway, we had to do something to get folks in here if we were going to stay afloat.
Mayor Carneros came up to me before a council meeting one night. Said he had a little idea.
City Council President Jay Teagle, who also owns the local newspaper, the Weekly Teagle.
Simple idea, he says. Make Oak Falls the first smoker's city. Legalize smoking everywhere in public. Encourage smokers to come here and raise a family as long as they're able. And every place else was, scaring them away. And Art, Mayor said, let's be the place they want to come to. I thought about it a minute, you know. Sounded kind of strange on first hearing and all. Then I said, Borax people aren't coming back. We got to do something. I got behind it faster than a heifer in heat.
Becoming a smoker's haven didn't just involve convincing the city's power elite. By its nature, it was a project that required all of Oak Falls to get behind it. Even non-smokers like Alma Lassito. For 21 years, Alma has poured coffee and served donuts at the Nibble Nook coffee shop.
Well, you know, it's a small community. And if you were thought to be a person standing in the way of civic improvement or something, people would let you know about their feelings very quickly. I'm not saying that happened in this situation, but, you know, I hate the smell of cigarettes personally, but from what I've seen, especially during this downturn, being out of a job smells worse, so we're just putting in a few more air fresheners in the place. The pine scent, you know, and we hope for the best.
We've been a little disappointed by the response so far. I guess with all the other things going on, the war and such, we haven't gotten as much media play as we thought, but we're taking the next step, and we're changing the town's name to make it fit in more with the kind of place that we are.
What's the new name to be, Mayor?
Well, we're having to hold a little referendum on that question this coming week. Some of us thought let's just be obvious and call it the town of Marlboro, but other folks, I guess more in keeping with their own tastes or something, want it to be called the town of Merritt Light. So we'll vote on it one way or another. When people come through on the state highway or see us on the maps, they'll know we're the smoker's town. And we think if they're smokers, they'll want to come here.
Down the road, if we even start thinking this might work, we're going to expand on it. There's some very serious talk about building a smoker's hall of fame here in town to pay tribute to some of the most accomplished people from all walks of life who've smoked.
You'd think that the tobacco industry would be behind the folks in Oak Falls like... Well, yes, like a heifer in heat. But Bill Turnage of the Tobacco Information Bureau in New York almost sounds as if he's, waiting for the smoke to settle.
We're very happy any time a community makes America's smokers feel welcome to exercise their rights to smoke. Don't get us wrong. But we don't necessarily want to endorse what this particular community is doing. Basically because we think that every town should be a smoker's town, if you will.
I'd just say to any smokers who are feeling persecuted or picked on, we know how you feel, and you're as welcome as can be in Marlboro or Merit Light.
Mayor Art Carneros, trying to keep the flame of small-town pride lit. I'm Aviva Schlarman.
And for this week, that's all for All in All. Funds for this program come from the CPR End of the Fiscal Year Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Ruminative Journalism and the Tobacco Foundation. I'm Ira Zipkin. Join us next week when we skim beneath the surface on another story of current near interest on All in All. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio. From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Book Bag. Book Bag, chit and chat about the fascinating world between the table of contents and the index. I'm Ira Zipkin in Washington. Nothing delights the publishing business more than a book that has progeny. A volume that has the popularity or resonance to inspire a sequel or sequels is like a publisher winning the Publisher's Clearinghouse. Think of the Chicken Soup series, the Four Dummies series, and the impending book mega-merger, the Chicken Soup for Dummies series. Our guest today may well be on the way to what we might call his own successful tribe. Tom Brokaw is best known as the respected, if perpetually boyish, anchor of the NBC Nightly News, but he's recently been spending as much time on the bestseller list as at the anchor desk. Starting with his book of memoirs by the folks who lived through World War II, The Greatest Generation, he's had two successive books on the subject of the World War II-era population cohort rocket up the lists. And now he's back for more. Tom Brokaw, welcome to the Book Bag.
Well, thank you, Ira. I don't know whether I can live up to the perpetually boyish description.
Or live down to it.
There you go.
Tom, you're fascinated by what you call the greatest generation, which a lot of people in our audience may just think of as our parents.
Well, exactly. And I think that's the lovely irony of this phenomenon. I'm a part of a generation that scorned our parents theatrically and passionately.
Yes.
Now I'm selling their parents back to them. In a way, I'm the vessel for a massive acknowledgement of a long-overdue debt.
A what of the debt?
Acknowledgement.
Oh, precisely. And your peers as readers are responding in record numbers, certainly more than are flocking, let's say, to the recent book-length works of Rather and Jennings.
Well, we're not in competition here. Yeah. These are all labors of love. You know, Peter's last book was just basically, here's the last 100 years, hope you enjoy them. And Dan, I don't know what Dan was doing exactly, but I think The Greatest Generation was more than an idea. You know, it's almost, if you start to think of it in broader terms, it's almost a brand.
In the sense that it can be applied to a great number of projects?
Exactly. Exactly.
Exactly, right. Mm-hmm. So this would explain what you're working on now?
Yeah. We basically used up all the memoir-type material.
The recollections of little moments of tragedy and bravery.
Uh-huh. But I felt that the greatest generation had more lessons to offer on all of the big questions in life that readers have. Questions like, how can I improve my management skills? Or how can I take weight off and keep it off? So the first two follow-on books...
I'm sorry?
Follow-on books. Management Secrets of the Greatest Generation and The Greatest Generation Diet. And I'll tell you, Ira, I've never had more admiration for these men and women who in all humility created the world we live in than when I was trying to think of what their management secrets or their diet would actually be like.
Actually be like.
That's right.
And without giving away the store, what would they be like?
Well, you have to remember, we're talking about people who were the children of the Depression.
Good point. And?
Well, just that you have to remember that. You know, for starters.
Right. So...
Well, that's really as far as I want to go. And
I understood. Mrs. Jennings and Rather might be listening.
No, really, Ira, we only compete on the air. And Dan, not even really there anymore.
Looking ahead, Tom, what else might the Greatest Generation have on its mind?
Well, we're compiling the 100 Greatest Travel Destinations of the Greatest Generation. That'll be a beautiful book, lavishly illustrated, probably Christmas year after next. And since most of the books in this series are bought by the members of the Greatest Generation themselves, some for them to give as gifts to their kids, you know, something to read about themselves. An associate of mine, a young man who was an intern at NBC, is working on the first draft of The Greatest Generation Learns Computing, which would be a step-by-step guide, lavishly illustrated with some wonderful photographs of these amazing veterans of World War II sitting at little tables and learning to use, I don't know, Word 2000 or the like.
Or the like, sure. Well, Tom, I know our audience is looking forward to all of these projects, and who knows, one day maybe a chicken soup for the Greatest Generation.
That's unlikely, Ira. I don't want to cheapen the thing.
Well, thank you for the visit.
My pleasure, and the Greatest Generation sends their best.
Oh, thank them. Support for Book Bag comes from the Pagination Foundation. Page numbers make the difference. Next time, more questions and answers about life between the covers. Until then, I'm Ira Zipkin, climbing out of the Book Bag. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
This is LeShow saluting Public Radio. Next, one of Public Radio's great storytellers recalls when Roseanne and Tom threatened to move to Minnesota.
Well, sir, it has been a quiet week in Television Center, Minnesota, my hometown. Mr. Bjornstrom down at the Bjornstrom Pharmacy, he got a little excited this week. Yes, he did. He had to take on the part-time boy Nils for an extra 2 hours. Just to clear some shelf space for the shipment of pancake makeup that just come in. Then he sort of wasted most of the first hour trying to figure out what exactly should give way to make room for the pancake makeup. The first aid supplies sort of had to stay prominently displayed, Mr. Bjornstrom said to himself. Though he said it to himself loud enough that Nils could hear it. First aid, in a way, was what the Bjornstrom Pharmacy had built its reputation on back in 78, the scaffolding on the redo of the sign of the Sugar Bowl coffee shop. Scaffolding came down a little prematurely due to an unforeseen gust of wind. And everybody trooped down the block to load up on Band-Aids at the Bjornstrom Pharmacy. Sort of put the place on the map. If the town had a map, which it's going to, what with the recent build-up business, Miss Roseanne and Mr. Tom and all coming in and setting up shop over at the old Sturmhart warehouse, which is now the Roseanne World Headquarters, don't you know? Which was the very reason that Mr. Bjornstrom had to clear some shelf space for the pancake makeup. Ordinarily, he said to himself, well, Nils listened in, ordinarily any TV show starts filming in your town, you're going to need to stock up on professional theatrical supplies if you don't want to lose all your business to the Super X down at the Five Points Mall. But, he says, well, considering whether the dentifrice section could be telescoped just a little bit, he says, common sense will tell you that this show uses little more than its share of pancake makeup. Well, Nels, who's now in the full bloom of the callowness of youth, Nels suggests that maybe the pharmacy could move the prophylactic devices from the two low shelves down near the heating duct and put the makeup stuff down there. And Dale Bjornstrom points out to the lad that fine makeups and heating ducts don't really mix. So he doesn't even have to get into the discussion about whether the full moral authority of Bjornstrom Pharmacy would be placed behind the idea of using prophylactic devices if they were displayed right there by the disposable pens and razors and the Reader's Digests and the little travel-size packets of Haley's M.O. And just then, the telephone rings. Mr. Bjornstrom leaves Nils, assigns him the task of counting up how many different kinds of Anacin and Bufferin the pharmacy is carrying so that maybe he could slim down the product lines a little bit. And he goes to his little office in the back of the pharmacy with the metal desk and the calendar with the four-color photograph of the Grand Canyon and a different side effect of Prozac listed for each month of the year, and the telephone. And when he picks it up, it's Evelyn Cladstrip down at the Sugar Bowl coffee shop. And she sounds upset. Victor and Evelyn had been setting about to closing up, it being almost 5 o'clock and all, and the Sugar Bowl being, by tradition, a lunch and breakfast place. And now Miss Roseanne comes in and sits down in the good booth. And she says to no one in particular, although Evelyn was the only one out front at the moment, Victor being back in the kitchen, defrosting some wieners for tomorrow's lunch. Miss Roseanne says, somebody bring me a menu while I'm still young. And Evelyn comes over real nice and explains as how the place is closed. But if Miss Roseanne had liked what's left of the coffee, she's more than welcome to it. And with that, Miss Roseanne pulls out some kind of walkie-talkie that the volunteer sheriff's department is about 5 years away from even requesting from the county. That's how sophisticated the thing looks, at least to Evelyn. And Miss Roseanne says some stuff into the walkie-talkie, and before Evelyn can get into the kitchen and get Victor's head out of the carton of wieners, Mr. Tom comes in. In no way is he pleased. He says to Evelyn, My wife has just finished one of the most horrendous days in the history of show business. Waiting for the members of whatever species you people breed around here to figure out how to operate the least complicated lighting board on the continent of North America. And you don't even have the common decency to serve the lady. Well, Evelyn was so embarrassed, and also at least a little bit afraid that Mr. Tom was thinking about throwing a sugar bowl at her head, she runs into the kitchen. And when I say that she runs, keep in mind that she's wearing that little waitress uniform with the big handkerchief and the skirt that, while it's not in the least unduly provocative, it isn't particularly blessed with a great deal of stretch as it gathers snugly about the knees. And also, Evelyn's the first to admit she's not exactly a spring chicken. She's the first to admit it only because if she wasn't, Victor'd be saying it all the time. So anyway, she runs kind of slowly. It's a panicky trot, a concerned and hobbled lope. And all the time that it takes her to make it back to the kitchen, Mr. Tom is calling after her. He's saying, I've got a good mind to buy you people out. Not because I'd get either any profit or pleasure out of owning this dump, but for the sole joy of being able to kick you out every time you showed your badly frosted head in the doorway. And then he and Miss Roseanne are alone. Evelyn finds Victor, and Victor wipes his hands on his apron and picks up about a dozen frozen wieners as a kind of a self-defense tool. And then Victor comes out into the coffee shop and just says very quietly, I'm sorry, we're closed. And Mr. Tom and Miss Roseanne gather up their things. And Victor says, as they're opening the door with the little bell and the big blue sugar bowl painted on its glass, he says, you know, the Sarnquist Bakery is just a couple blocks down the street, and they stay open most nights till 6. And Mr. Tom slams the door so hard that the little bell falls off. And the painted sugar bowl pretty near falls off, too. And so Evelyn had called Dale Bjornstrom, partly because she was still a little bit scared, and partly because he was going to play Scrabble that evening, as usual, with Ben Vinton, who writes the Seen and Heard About Town column for the Television Center Weekly Tribune. And she thought that he ought to know. Dale Bjornstrom sighed, said that he'd tell Ben. Probably any time Ben looked like he was on the verge of coming up with a 7-letter word. And then he told Evelyn not to worry, probably nothing more would happen. But that she and Victor probably should think about keeping open a little later for the show folk. And then Mr. Bjornstrom said goodbye to her. And he eased himself out of his little swivel chair. He comes back into the store. And while he's been on the phone, Nils just taking it onto himself to clear just enough room on the shelves that feature the skincare products to make display space for all the little circular containers of a pancake makeup. And Mr. Bjornstrom just looks at it, and then he looks at Nils, and he thinks for a moment. He says to Nils, your folks aren't raising an idiot boy. Now go wash up before I owe you for another hour. That's the news from Television Center, Minnesota, where all the people work in television, and none of the people are like the folks in television. Well, thank you so much.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is More Than You Know. More Than You Know, the weekly public radio series that focuses on events and personalities outside your ken. I'm Jacob Kitzel. Radio is about sound. Today, mainly the sound of music and the sound of voices. Here in public radio, there are many voices you think you know, and one that you probably don't realize that you do. CPR's special correspondent, Aviva Schlorman, introduces you to Henry Pensacola.
We're in a small recording studio deep inside the bowels of public radio. Outside, in the hallways and offices, there's hustle and bustle. News is being covered, opinions are being shared, decisions are being postponed. But here inside Studio 4J, one man stands in the beam of light thrown by a track lighting canister. He squints just a bit at the words on the paper that sits on the music stand. And then, as he does every day, he begins to weave his spell.
Support for this program comes from WayneKilgoreWillis.com. Information solutions that take the obvious a step beyond. Online at www.wkw.com.org. Jastro, a world of fingertips at your fingertips. www.jastro.com. The Republic of Liechtenstein, for coverage of Teutonic culture. Liechtenstein, we're in Europe too. And from the Public Broadcasting Foundation, making tax exemptions work twice as hard. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
That's great, Henry. That's a take.
Is it okay?
Yes, Henry. That's a take. There's a keeper.
Good. Onward.
Henry Pensacola has been in public radio for almost a decade. This Sephardic Jew with the shock of black hair and the shy smile spends his days inside Studio 4J, reading the funding credits at the beginning and end, and increasingly in the middle of all our programs. Henry Pensacola is the most recognizable voice on our air, and yet you've never met him. Till now.
For the first couple of years here, I did a little bit of everything. I covered the environment beat. I hosted the Buffalo Philharmonic concerts. I was Scrooge when the news staff did their production of A Christmas Carol. But ultimately, as we all do, I began to specialize.
Henry, what was it about funding credits that drew you to specialize in them?
Well, they didn't seem to be read with any consistency, I guess. Anybody who had a spare moment would be brought in here to go through a bunch of them. Some people treated it as a sort of a chore. I convinced management that in the same way that every program's identity is wrapped up in a voice or two, our funding credits needed that same kind of identity. And I don't suppose it hurt that I tend to pronounce things pretty carefully.
Oh, the funders like that.
I suppose they do.
Henry, you make all the funding credits sound so easy, but I'm sure there have been some difficult challenges. Does any one stand out as particularly troublesome?
Well, there was one that was very difficult to keep a straight face during.
What was that?
The corporation had a grant from the American Bison Council. I think their slogan was, "Introducing a new generation to the other red meat."
And?
Something about it just broke me up. It took me about 24 takes to get it right.
Well, there's a famous tape of you that circulates inside the building here, isn't there?
Oh, you've heard it. Yes, we had a grant from the Marjorie Shuggin Foundation. It gives money for the coverage of America's intellectual life, mm-hmm. and their catchphrase was "Shuggin, fit for brains." I don't know where my brain was that day, but some letters got switched around,
and the highlight of every public radio Christmas party was born.
I guess it was.
Every day, the funding department sends Henry a printout of the day's financial supporters. Every day, he wrestles with nuances of tone and pronunciation.
A lot of them are our regulars, mm-hmm. you know, your agribusiness giants, your foreign countries, mm-hmm. and rich families have been with us all along, mm-hmm. but every day there's some new internet investment service with the unpronounceable names of four partners or a medical foundation supporting coverage of a disease that you've never heard of because, to be fair, there hasn't been coverage. Let me put it this way. Every day there's some reason why we don't get to lunch before 1:30.
But there are times, aren't there, where you get to exercise a little more creativity?
Well, as with almost everything else, there are slow seasons for public radio fundraising. I don't pretend to know the reasons, budgetary constraints, mm-hmm. End of fiscal years, that sort of thing.
Of course.
Anyway, when those times roll around, we used to just slow down the reading. Say, we just had one funder,
mm-hmm.
in a slot where we normally would have three, and if there was nobody to credit, we just had this little piece of music we played. Well, that became known around the stations as the Poor House Suite. And I got memos that my slow reading was driving people a little nuts.
How slow was it?
Let's see. Support for this program comes from the TV Guide Foundation, helping to build awareness of jazz. About like that.
No, that must be hard to do.
Well, it's very hard to keep your concentration. Your mind tends to wander off during the pauses, so I began making up funders, you know, foundations and corporations that sound just like the real ones.
Mm-hmm.
So now, instead of us advertising that it's a slow time, we sound as if we're sold out year-round.
Henry, do you get fan mail?
I've gotten marriage proposals, one from a woman who wrote that hearing my voice always made her think of good things like disease prevention, the environment, and the arts. And she liked that.
Okay, Henry, just do the ending one more time for us.
Okay. Rolling?
Just a minute.
Mm.
Okay, yes, we're rolling now.
This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Yes, that's a good one, Henry. See you tomorrow.
All right. Bye-bye.
When Henry Pensacola leaves Studio 4J, he and his engineer are the only persons who know what credits have been recorded in what sequence for airing on what program. It's a security precaution based on necessity.
A few years ago, management here learned that people at the stations around the country, you know, the announcers and the engineers waiting to do the local break,
mm-hmm.
They were running gambling pools on what the credits would be.
Gambling pools?
Yes, you know, at the end of this half hour, it'll be such and such a foundation,
mm-hmm.
or such and such a movie for smart people. Mm-hmm. These folks were betting large sums of money, well, large for public radio, and there was some concern that people who got inside information in advance as to what credits were going to actually run could take advantage of the situation.
Oh, my goodness.
So, Like everything else in this modern world, we now have airtight security. Just for having heard that session of Eva, we now have to kill you and your crew.
Henry Pensacola, giving credits where credits are due. Sworn to secrecy in Washington, I'm Aviva Schlorman.
The approach of baseball's All-Star Game is a bittersweet time for commentator Bixby Knowles.
I shoved my gloved arm halfway up a hepatitic calf this week. I came face to face with myself. Mortality stared at me like a tourist through that animal's eyes, and I knew summer was half over. All-star games mean that here in Wyoming. They signal it's time to start to prepare for fall. There are sheep to inoculate against pink ear, swine that need their teeth cleaned. When the all-star teams are announced, while other fans think of green outfields, I think of a goat that must be fitted with a truss before the first snow. Plenty of time for joy next summer. This one's almost over.
Bixby Knowles is a large animal poet and free verse veterinarian who lives in Cody, Wyoming. He comes to us from member station KIOU. And for this week, that's More Than You Know.
Here lies a place, won't let me languish. Here's all my footsteps and ways. Watch how she fades into the sunset. A vision spectacular. Travel stimulating discussion with me. Faster into the weakness, off the wall into blackness, gifted. Red eyes reflect. Open the suitcase. Spread all your clothes on. Was 10 years ago. Time on the clock. I don't want to waste it. Hunger for the well traveled, stimulating discussion. Lift me faster into the weakness, off the wall into blackness. I'm away from home.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, I'm Aviva Schlorman, and this is Up to Here. Up to Here, the CPR Daily Magazine of Almost News. The U.S. Postal Service, beset with competition from the private shippers like DHL and Federal Express, has decided not to raise the price of postage stamps for at least another year. Having thus taken care of the future, the quasi-governmental corporation is taking a good long look at its past, hopefully before the lawyers do. Ira Zipkin reports. 47 times a minute, this automatic sorting and routing machine dispatches a letter or postcard onto its destination automatically by optically scanning the address. 42 times a minute, postal worker Dorothy Bottoms catches up with some error in the sorter's software program. But lately, Dorothy's been less able to keep up with the machine's mistakes, and that's had her worried.
I had these blinding headaches, and all the zip codes began to get all blurry and such. I went to the post office health plan doctor, and that's when I found out about the experiment.
During the 1920s, the post office department, which was a predecessor agency to the Postal Service, was concerned about the ability of mail delivery to survive a nuclear attack.
Dr. Morton Kramer is director of radiological affairs for the U.S. Postal Service.
So random postal workers had their coffee and donuts laced with random levels of plutonium. The question being, at what dose would worker effectiveness be impaired?
And at what dose was it impaired?
Well, on a short-term basis, really no impairment occurred until what was even then, and they knew so much less back then, even then was recognized as a lethal dose. That put a crimp in the sorting for sure.
And at lower doses?
Well, it depends whom you believe. If you believe the lawyers of people like Dorothy Bottoms, it had a serious effect some 30 years later. If you believe our attorneys, she probably just sat too close to her TV set during the 50s.
Were these people aware what was happening to them?
Well, I'm going to ignore the larger implications of that question as to whether any of us is aware of what's happening to us, but the technology of gaining consent was a lot more primitive in those days. You had to actually write individually to people. We didn't have robotypers or laser printers, of course, and frankly, we just didn't have the manpower allocated in the post office budget to do all that typing. So as best we're able to reconstitute the spotty records that were kept, there were signs posted in the snack rooms advising workers that the donuts contained extra nutrients and the coffee was really hot.
In retrospect, knowing what we know now, these experiments were, I guess you'd have to say, ill-advised.
Tucker Ramsgate is Deputy Associate Administrator of the Postal Service.
I mean, so many of our functions are automated today, and more are coming online all the time, of course, so to deal with the same questions that we were asking back then and to do it in a responsible and a useful way, we'd have to subject the machinery to random plutonium dosage, which we are doing. And just to show you that we have learned something from our experience, we're fully informing and gaining full legal consent from all of the equipment manufacturers.
Meanwhile, back at the automatic sorting machine, postal worker Dorothy Bottoms still doesn't know how much, if any, of the plutonium she may have ingested, or not.
I didn't drink coffee every day. And I hated those donuts. They were like rocks. So, I don't know. Maybe I did sit too close to the TV. The screen was so small back then. This machine feels kind of hot, doesn't it?
I'm Ira Zipkin at the post office. You wouldn't think that a retired baseball broadcaster's meandering observations on tropical flora and well-remembered incidents from half a century ago would make for fascinating radio, let alone a fascinating book. And you might well be right, but my colleague Chris Edwards, whose weekly conversations with Red Butcher were a regular staple of CPR's Morning Condition, has just come out with a book about those conversations. It's called The Wisteria Are Blooming and DeRocher Never Spat. Chris, I know better than anybody how hard it is to sift through years of broadcast chat to come up with a plausible book. Mm. How difficult was it for you?
Well, I made a couple of key decisions right at the start, Aviva. I said we'd go in a chronological order and that we'd use every 10th broadcast. that made the winnowing a lot easier.
Well, it's sort of self-winnowed.
Mm-hmm, very much. Red was such a colorful character, but the colors were always the same. So I didn't have to worry about leaving anything crucial out.
Chris, what does the title mean? The wisteria blooming in Durocia never spat?
Well, Red always talked about whatever flowers were blooming at that time of year.
Well, I think we have an excerpt.
Good morning, Red.
Good morning, Colonel. Wisteria looking pretty perky right about now.
Is that particular passage in the book?
I think so. Sounds familiar.
And as for Durocia never spat?
Oh, that was the punchline of a joke, Red. Once told me off the air, I couldn't print the story because it was, well, you know, baseball locker room humor.
Well, I know women in media luncheon humor. That can be pretty brutal.
Well, suffice to say, the punchline was the only part I could really use, so I put it in the title as a tribute to Red's saltier side.
Chris, what made you so fond of Red's stories? You actually took a year off with pay to compile this book.
Well, Viva, it was like talking to an old friend that you didn't really know.
Mm.
Also, you know, being in the news business, you have to work so hard to verify anything you put on the air. Well, everybody in Red stories was dead, so whether they were true or not, you could just sit back and enjoy them.
Chris, best of luck with the book. I understand some of the proceeds go to...
11th Inning House. It's a facility for retired baseball broadcasters down in Winter Haven.
Chris Edwards, the author?
I guess you can call it that. You do.
I do indeed. The author of The Wisteria Are Blooming in Durocia Never Spat. And for today, you've had it up to here. Up to Here is made possible by a grant from the Snickers Foundation. Today's sugary snacks, funding the future. I'm Aviva Schlorman. Join me next time when we bring you Up to Here. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's people like you that make public radio possible. It's people like me that make it necessary.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's telethon season, and that means I've got to be back home to do a fresh, live, brand new edition of Le Show next week at this same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network. On shortwave, yeah, we got that. WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz. Is that enough shortwave for you? Are those waves short enough for you? And on your computer, whenever you want it, at two locations, wherever you are in the world, actually. www.kcrw.com and www.harryshearer.com. And it would be just like you being the you in public radio, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast. Yes, we read them. Sometimes we answer them, but no attachments, please. Is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.
You've been listening to Le Show with Harry Scherer. Coming up in just a moment, it's The Next Big Thing. At 12 noon, Tom Schnabel opens Cafe LA, and Weekend Becomes Eclectic at 2 o'clock. That's all here on KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9, KCRI Indio Palm Springs 89.3, KCRY Mojave Antelope Valley 88.1, and KCRU Oxnard Ventura 89.1. KCRW is your radio home for NPR news and hand-picked music, streaming three channels at kcrw.com and radio at AOL. KCRW is a community service of Santa Monica College.
Don't miss the landmark exhibition, Milton Avery, the late paintings featuring colorful seascapes, portraits, landscapes, and interiors by this influential American modernist. Now on view at the UCLA Hammer Museum on Wilshire Boulevard in Westwood. Open daily except on Mondays and late on Thursdays when admission is free for everyone. Check out the website at www.hammer.com.